collecting the object of refuge, the field of merit. In this case, very simple. Vishakhamuni in his heart is Prajnaparamita. In her heart abides the very subtle wind and mind of the Buddha, any Buddha, a Buddha. And with a great aversion to that's how you put it, you know, to, if you say samsara, it's so easy. With a great aversion to the habits that cause us to again and again create the cause for future suffering for ourselves and for others, we turn our minds to the Buddhas, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Buddha is shown through his great wisdom and compassion. And all the people that came after him created this whole system of transforming an ordinary human body and mind into that of a Buddha. And the step-by-step gradual way of slowly lessening and lessening our grasping at the I and all the delusions that come from that. And so with that great care for ourselves and with the wish to generate an equally caring for others. And some people are better at caring for others for themselves. So also an equally caring for self is for others, as how it is in some cases. But anyway, an equanimous care for all beings, including ourselves, no one more than the other. Knowing that being kind and patient and gracious is the best way to proceed in the life, just even to have a happy life, and then ultimately to recognize the direct realization of the true nature of self and others, so that we can completely transcend these contaminated aggregates controlled by delusion and karma and transform them into the five Dhyani Buddhas and experience the enlightened state. And so this reason we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge through giving and other perfections. To aid all may I become Buddha. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge through giving and other perfections, to aid all may I become Buddha. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge, through giving and other perfections, to aid all may I become Buddha. Feeling the blessings pouring into us and from us out to all sentient beings. Purifying all those habits that need to be purified and bringing in the ones that we need to adopt. In this case, particularly recognizing that everything we experience comes from our own mind. And so there's no reason to blame anybody. We don't even need to blame ourselves. We just need to understand that due to this ignorance, we have habits that create causes for suffering, and our job is to stop that. And for that, we need a calm and peaceful nervous system. And so I thought we could try the taps, because we've talked about it, we haven't done it yet. And I'll just do the way I learned. I think it's almost the same as Carl's. But the way I learned is you take these fingers, you know, and it's a pretty firm tap. I mean, that doesn't hurt, but, and you tap your eyebrows. And the plate, there's a acupuncture point right in the middle of the eyebrows, but there's also one, and the inside of the eyebrows, you know. So with the three fingers, you get both places. And you just breathe naturally while you tap for a little while. And for most people, those points are, you can feel that they're point acupuncture points because they're a bit sore. But while you're doing this, we can be, you know, relaxing the jaw, breathing into the base, into the perineum. Lifting up the rib cage with the breath and letting the neck relax by tucking in the chin just a little bit, not a whole lot. Allowing the shoulders to relax. Feeling a hollow breathing body. Then you do just below the eyes. If you move around, you find a place that's a little more sensitive than others. Letting all that nervous energy comes in the form of thoughts, just dissolve down through the lower doors into the earth. And then at the top of the jaw, in front of the ears, and use that to feel how tight your jaw is, you know, and just feel the bones separating there instead of being, some people's jaws are so tight with all the tendons and muscles from clenching their jaws when they get tense and nervous. And you can also alternate. We'll try that another time. Just do it one way now. And then you just take one hand and go right beneath the nose, in between, and right at the bottom of the nose, top of the lip. I always find when I do this, it's much easier to breathe into my belly. Already my body's relaxing, you know. Because that's one of the places I tense. I tense my abdominal muscles. And then the chin, just below the teeth. You feel that allows the jaw to relax more in the back of the head. Sort of just feel like all that tension, it's like you're in a hot bath, kind of melting. And another thing we can do too is just notice that sense of I. And notice that the more you relax, the less intense the feeling of I is, which is why relaxation is so important to realizing meditative emptiness. And then here. Feel how that allows the upper lung area to expand, and you can breathe more fully into your lungs. As Carl was saying, you can also do it this way. So if you're in the supermarket, it's a little bit less noticeable. And then the heart meridian. And then just let your hands fall down on your knees. And just take a big breath and just completely let go and just, you know, notice how you feel inside. And we'll just do simple breathing meditation, relaxing our mind. And then recollecting the Buddha in the space above us, and imagine that every time we breathe in, without having to use your intellect, just know that when you're breathing in, that the blessings of the Buddha are coming in and filling you with love and compassion and wisdom, skillful means. And when you breathe out, it goes out through all your pores and touches all sentient beings throughout infinite space. And allow that image and those feelings and that soft breathing to be soothing. We need to soothe ourselves, learn to soothe our mind and body. We can add to that a sense of deep forgiveness. We talked about that earlier today. And just imagine that the blessing of the Buddha is coming in and giving us the capacity to deeply forgive ourselves and anyone who we've ever felt wronged by. We don't need to be thinking about karma or I created the cause. Just feel there are waves of Buddha's forgiveness just pouring into your body, soothing your heart, healing your organs, and giving it to all beings, particularly those you need to forgive. Just have faith that it's happening in every cell of the body. And then we can just imagine that the Buddha dissolves, you know, like when you turn the defroster on your windshield, it dissolves into Mother Prajna Paramita. And she dissolves into her subtle wind and mind. And that very bright, shining union of bliss and emptiness comes to the crown of our heads and dissolves. It doesn't dissolve, it just comes down and sits on the lotus and moon in our heart. We can relax for meditation. I seem to have left my coffee upstairs. I guess I think I had it at the time. So, okay, great. Take that. So let's just read the part A again, okay? Gather all blame into one, Meditate on the great kindness of all. Train alternately in giving and taking. Begin the sweepings by taking from your own side. Mount these two upon the breath. The three objects, the three poisons, and the three virtuous roots are the brief instruction for the subsequent attainment. To remember this, train in every activity by words. So, we've kind of gone through all of this except for the three objects, the three poisons, and the three virtuous roots. And, of course, I don't remember what they are, and I had them written down upstairs. I didn't bring it down. But maybe in your book, someone has Trungpa's book, or I could run and get it. But I know that the three objects are like, you know, friend, enemy, and stranger, something like that. And the three poisons are attachment, hatred, and ignorance. And the three virtuous roots, actually I do remember them, are the antidotes to that. You know, so non-attachment, you know, not anger and not ignorance. So that's what that's about. I mean, that's pretty clear. All this is quite simple. Oh, this is Geshe Rapin's book. What is this book? You got that book.
Yes.
Oh, great. Yeah, this is the book I learned with. Let's see what he says. Okay, yeah. So we have agreeable objects, objects of aversion, objects of ignorance, and then, you know, well, it is what I said, so that's good. And then there are antidotes. So when it says to remember this, train in every activity by words, it means basically it's like learn these slogans and learn different things that you can do, like if you're the kind of person that wants to have little prompts you can remember, you know, like the eight verses or, you know, these ones here, you know, like, you know, do not follow delusions, do not retaliate to verbal abuse, do not wait in ambush. And so I think the idea is if you were to memorize all these things, these antidotes, then as you go throughout the day and things arise, you can remind yourself, you know, or whatever else you like to remember, you know. And I'll just share with you my experience is that for me, I need more than that, because that's why I spend so much emphasis on, you know, Qigong and the body and stuff, because I'm like you, you know, like Amanda. I mean, if something arises, you know, I mean, I'm a little better now, but if, you know, if one of the objects of attachment or anger, it's not so much ignorance, we don't even know an ignorant, we're always ignorant. I mean, we're always in ignorance, you know, we always don't. Unless we really remind ourselves that, you know, the I doesn't exist from its own side, then, you know, pretty much the mind goes one with the poison, you know, the detachment or the aversion. But I found if I remember my body, you know, if I remember I have hands, feet, remember my feet on the ground, I remember to breathe, then that helps me have that. Remember the first day I talked about we need that space, you know, we need to have that. Need to cultivate that mindfulness muscle that helps us not react immediately. And so for me, that the way I can do that is when I just remember to breathe, you know, because when I remember my breathing, then I kind of remember that spaciousness. I can remember Tom Lin, you know, so it helps me. I mean, I'm not saying we don't need the words, we need the words. But for me, you know, I think we're all so much in our head anyway, that to really stop that, I need something. I need it more with my winds. And that might just be me, you know. I mean, everybody's different. But I encourage you to kind of figure out what works for you to help you stay mindful throughout the day. But one of my teachers a long time ago, before I met the Dharma, you know, because he was more like a, well, he did Feldenkrais work and Alexander technique and, you know, lots of different things and Qigong and stuff. He was a black belt in karate. And he used to say, you know, just remember you have hands, feet, and a head. And if you can just remember, you know, hands, feet, and head, even when you start to get angry, that helps, you know. I remember telling my mom that about 20 years ago. Somehow it just helps to, like, not be oneness with it, you know. Because for me anyway, it just kind of spreads it out. You know, it's sort of like, it's not so quite in your face, you know. But does anybody else have any tricks? What are your tricks? What do you do? Anybody have any?
A little while ago, well, a couple of years ago now, I learned 6-6 breathing, mm-hmm. where you breathe in for six and out
for six.
And you, as you breathe in, you kind of make a noise, and when you breathe out, you make a noise. It's very calming.
Yeah, it is very calming. Yeah. Or Ujjayi breath is what they call that in yoga, you know. You know, and another one, too, I learned a lot of these things listening to radio, like the tapping, you know, was some psychologist, trauma healer, was talking about square breathing. Have you ever heard of square breathing? It's a pranayama, really.
4-4-4.
Yeah, 4-4-4. You breathe in 4.
Hold 4.
Breathe out 4.
Is that
four.
The one that's supposed to be really helpful at getting you to sleep? If you can't sleep, mm-hmm. it does work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's called square breathing, and you can do it in 4 counts or 6 counts. And it's very helpful to, like, the tapping, you know, and nobody sees that. But, I mean, we can't go around doing square breathing all the time. So I'm just talking about when someone just comes up and says, you're a jerk, you know. What do you do then, you know? And most of the time, if we stay relaxed enough, it's okay. But there are those times when we're distracted. And that's, I think, the situation is, if you have children, you're almost always distracted. So it's very difficult to, in fact, this is when we get on, later on it says, the sign of having well trained is that you can practice even when you're distracted. You know, and most of us are distracted all the time. So just by our own inner words, you know, inner blah, 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 you know, we're distracted. So that's why I keep thinking, you know, in this day and age, these kind of breathing things, which is, I think, why so many people now are drawn to yoga. Because it's the only time when their mind stops is after a yoga class. Especially pranayama yoga is really helpful. And Lou, our little friend, chef here, she has studied pranayama for a long time, and she teaches it. And I didn't do it in this retreat, but in some of my retreats, I'll ask her to come in and do pranayama with us, like the first half an hour in the morning. So, but really all it is the counting. You know, you count... Four. I mean, she does it like you start out with like 4 and you hold 2 and you exhale 4 and you 2 and then you build up 6 and 4 and out 6 and out 4. You know, she does it like that and up to 8 and up to 10. And those kind of practices are really, really beneficial, especially to help you get to sleep or just to stay relaxed. And, you know, you don't really have to take a class to count your breath. You can just learn to do it. So,
is what I use if I do get to do the meditation, my mind's just going. Yeah. Is the 9 step?
The 9 round breathing. I haven't taught that yet.
And I find that so calming.
Yeah, I find the tapping more calming than 9 round breathing.
I find the tapping exhausting.
Do you?
Afterwards, I can't even think.
Well, then it's not your thing, you know. Maybe it might help if you have insomnia. But, I mean, that's the thing. There are all these different techniques, you know, because it's up to us to figure out what works. You know, I haven't done the 9 round breathing yet, but we can do it tomorrow morning.
For me, the 9 round breathing actually elevates my heart rate. So I don't actually find it calming at all. It's not agitating, but I just can feel like the blood pumping through me. So I can't do it in the evening. I find it, too
stimulating. So it's interesting, isn't it, how everyone's different. And there's another one that I'll do with us. I might even get to it tonight if we don't have that much to talk about, then that I find really helpful too. And it's, I think I told you about it. It's with the organs and colors and emotions. Mm-hmm. And that one calms me down the most, I think. So we can try that. But anyway, so that's training in the conventional bodhicitta. So, I mean, you know, train alternately in giving and taking. We didn't talk a whole lot about about meditating on the great kindness of all, but we talked about it quite a bit in the discussion. And I really liked Pauline's comment about the bullies, you know, thanking the bully, even to the point where you wrote them, you know, you actually thanked them, you know. And I think that every challenging situation as a Buddhist practitioner, the trick is to see it all as a learning experience. Because in the end, you know, the mind, a well-trained mind just stays calm and clear and open and focused, whatever's going on. And so we have to see these things that interrupt that as that's our training time. And so that's why we say when seeing a being of wicked nature is overwhelmed by heavy non-virtue and suffering, we hold them her dear. And you know the story of Atisha's cook, right? You all heard the story of Atisha's cook. Atisha, who brought these teachings to Tibet, had traveled with this really obnoxious person that just drove everybody in his entourage crazy. But he said, how am I ever going to learn patience if I don't have a obnoxious person around me all the time? But maybe he didn't use the word obnoxious. I think that doesn't mean that, you know, we have to, I mean, he was a great practitioner as well, you know. But in those situations, we can see them as precious gifts because they are helping us to practice patience and to develop tenderness and loving care and recognizing what it is about us that how we need to change, you know. So really, if we just have everything smooth all the time, we'll never learn anything. You know, we might deal a little bit better with our distracted mind, but we won't really learn how to practice. That's why these Dharma centers, if you've ever been in one,
I've seen a few.
They're real cauldrons of practice because there's just something about all the energy and the holy objects that brings up people's things. And unless you were a hippie in the 70s, I don't think that many people live in groups anymore. It used to be a thing, you know, communal living. Although I think still, I know in the United States, the rents are so really high that people have to live together now. Young people have to live together. Maybe not so much by choice, but I think, I don't know if it's so much like trying to have community, you know. And so, you know, everybody's different and everybody gets on everybody's nerves and it's very exhausting and, you know, I mean, not all the time. And so they're really great places to learn to practice, even though you do need to take breaks and take it in pieces. It can be very exhausting.
London is a great place to practice. Everyone rents and shares.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everywhere is a great place to practice. Any relationship is a great place to practice. Any kind of relationship. You know? The people that are the closest to you are the ones that, and that's one of them too. One of them, we'll get to them. There's one about that too. I think it's always meditate on special cases. Your son, you know, it's your special case. And, you know, you can think about, well, you know, this is my time to learn and giving yourself as much help as possible, you know, in those situations, you know. And I think in knowing when you need a break is really important, but sometimes we don't get that break. Sometimes it's just relentless. And I know we've all been through phases in our lives when it's just one relentless, challenging situation after another, and there's no way to escape except in our sleep. And then even sometimes our sleep, we can't sleep because it's so upsetting, you know. So I think it's at that time that we really need to take refuge and call and ask. You know, one thing I remember Carolyn Miss, who's a Christian, but she still really has a lot of really good information to. And, I mean, it doesn't matter if she's Christian. It's great. She's good. But She one time she said something like, "You need to shout at God, you know, like go out and just yell, you know." I mean, not that we believe in God, but maybe the kind of God she believes in, you know. So just really pray, you know, like just yell, I need this help right this minute, you know. So I tried it one time and it really did help, you know. So when you're in, you know, when you're in a hard situation, don't forget to ask. You know, the Buddhas are there all the time, you know, and all we have to do is ask and be willing to receive the guidance that we need, you know. You can ask in the middle of a situation. You can ask before you go to sleep at night. I really like to ask for a sign in a dream. I don't always get it, and now my life's more busy. It's harder to remember my dreams, but, you know, dreams are very educational, you know, just looking at what's going on in your dream and try to figure it out, you know. But sometimes those signs will come in dreams, or, you know, something, you pick up the book and there it is, you know, or, you know, but I think it's really important to verbalize what it is that we need, you know, because another thing, I think I said it here yet, but another thing about our culture, at least for me anyway, was feeling shamed about having needs, you know, especially if you grew up like a lot of people in post-World War II in London, you know, everyone was so poor. You weren't allowed to say, oh, geez, could I have a second helping of potatoes even? Or, you know, I really don't really want to wear that dress, but you have to because it's the only one that's being given to you. Your parents don't have enough money to go out and buy you a dress, you know, so you just wear what you're given, you know.
And also eat the food even though you don't like it.
Yeah,
and
eat the food.
You can't actually stomach it.
No.
You've got to eat it.
You've got to eat it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know Jeff can't eat cooked apples because he was forced to eat them, and if he didn't
eat beans for the same
yeah reason. And if he didn't eat them, he'd get beaten, you know, by the nun wherever he was, you know, because he was in poor homes, you know, he grew up in those, what they call them, the workhouses.
Workhouse.
Yeah, some of the time anyway. So I think a really big issue for us is needs, you know. And knowing what our needs are, and even just basic ones like being safe, having friends, you know, to the bigger ones like needing self-esteem and needing a meaningful job and needing a community. You know, Maslow talks about needs, you know, another psychologist. And so I think, you know, I mean, that's not a bad thing to make a list too, you know. What are my needs? Because we feel it's like we're not allowed to ask, you know. But if we don't ask, we're never going to get them. And look how old we are now. And we're still, you know, afraid to ask for our needs, you know. And you'd be surprised if you start asking. So be really careful what you ask for. That's the other thing. Because when you begin to ask with bodhicitta motivation, you know, really sincere, like, I need to get enlightened. So for that reason, I need support, or I need this, or I need that, you know. And as long as your motivation is pure, you can ask for whatever you need and completely don't worry about it, you know. And generally speaking, it'll happen. Usually, you know. There may be some purification that happens, has to happen first, but, you know. And the other thing we haven't spoken about too much is purification. That there are three main practices, really, in Buddhism, and that there's purifying past karmas and creating the cause for future karmas, and then making the requests, the needs thing, you know. Because if you're purifying your past karmas and you're creating future karmas, that means you're building up your potential for enlightenment, you know. But unless you direct that, it could end up, you know, you just end up a really rich person next lifetime. So it's important. It's like you're building a I like to think of it as a boat, you know, or some kind of ship that's going to take you to enlightenment. But you have to have the navigation and the rudder and be saying, you know, and really with intention, you know, not just I'm going to enlightenment, but the steps you need along the way. I need the right teacher, or I need a retreat place, or, you know, I need the right circumstances, or, you know, I need to be less lonely, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, because even though our goal is enlightenment, that doesn't mean we can't be nourished along the way. And I think we really miss that one, especially monks and nuns. They think renunciation means you don't take care of yourself anymore. You know, like I have to give up everything. And renunciation is not about giving up anything except worldly dharmas and grasping and self-cherishing and delusions. It doesn't mean we can't enjoy life. So we make that mistake in Buddhism, you know, and Christianity too, you know. So, like I know, you know, as an ordained person in a Christian culture, people think you have a vow of poverty. Well, nobody vows to be a poor nun. You don't want to be a poor nun, you know. You don't have to be a poor nun. But a lot of people think that's part of the job, isn't it? And they shame you if you're not poor, you know, right?
We are quite poor.
I know. Yeah. I mean, not all the nuns, not all the monks and nuns, a lot of them have trust funds, actually, which is, if you're a trust fund person, why not become, you know, why not use that precious human rebirth? But other people like Barbara and myself, you know, just beggars. And people don't realize that they need support. So, so they end up like just working at Dharma centers for nothing. And given the worst jobs too, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit of what it's like?
Well, I mean, I'm lucky because I worked as a nurse, and although I didn't work all my career because I was in India as well for a long time, at least I've got enough money per month that covers my rent from my nurse's pay, because Geshe Teshe never wanted nuns to live at Jamyang, and it's going to be more like that because there's no rooms, to be honest. There's no room for us anyway. And I get a state pension, which covers because the other money all goes on the rent and the council tax. Because the trouble is, you're better off not having anything, because then you can get top-ups. I can't get any top-ups. But I've got enough. Mm-hmm. But now that I don't have much money to go on retreats, that's what's so good about here.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, most of the centres in England now don't charges, do they? The FBMT centres. You can go to anything.
That's good.
Okay. Jamyang, well, we've never charged if you don't have the money at Jamyang.
Mm.
So you have to pay for your room, though. Mm. It's not easy, because I don't have, you know, because my parents died a long time ago. And but I'm all right. I've got enough, but I haven't got enough for any extras.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, my brother's come back from the States, and he gave me the money to go to Riga to see Rinpoche, and the money to go to Rotterdam to see His Holiness. Because I spent more than about the first 50 years providing money for him. So it's good it's coming back a bit. And then I'm going to Rinpoche's retreat in Bendigo again. I've only been once before, and a friend has sponsored my airfare. Just the whole of it.
That's great.
Isn't that good? Without even... So that's good.
Yeah.
So maybe just eventually, sometimes, but I don't really need much.
Yeah, well, I think on the Dharma path, when you really give up, you know, your job and everything, you never have a lot. And Buddha never said you'd have a lot, but you always have just enough.
Yeah.
You know, just enough. And that's good enough, because then you don't accumulate too much stuff and you don't have a lot of worldly dharmas. And also life's simpler when you don't have a lot of money and stuff. But, so...
So I recommend you all become sangha.
And then, just to get back to meditate on the great kindness of all, you know, I whenever I'm having a difficulty with somebody, it seems like the thing that gets me out of it the fastest is gratitude. You know, like I'll think about, okay, maybe there feels like harm coming now, you know. Because, you know, even though I know I created the cause for it, I still have to deal with the fact that I feel harmed. You know, I mean, it's not just going to go away because I know I created the cause for it. I mean, maybe for a great lama, but for me, I still have to, you know, apply antidotes and things. And the one that works for me is just gratitude, just remembering the good things that person did for me. You know, even if it's just teaching me patience, it's still a good thing, you know. So, yeah, and I think that we also talked about remembering that everybody's just looking for happiness, you know, and we can always think that everyone's giving me the opportunity to meditate on kindness, compassion, emptiness, patience, you know, all these things. So that's what that one's about, meditating the great kindness of all. And all of these steps, you know, we need, as it tells in the teachings, you know, you need to study and contemplate and meditate. And so they're pretty simple, but the more you can take each one and really think about it and work with it and make it your own, you know, practices shouldn't, we need to parrot practices. We need to take practices into our heart and create the language and the style that will touch our hearts. You know, just like we said, you know, nine-round breathing doesn't work for you. You know, it works for you. So, you know, and it's the same with all of these steps here. You know, we have to kind of practice, you know, working with whatever works. Did you want to say something, Pauline? I thought you were going to say something before. So I'm about to move on from this one. Does anyone have anyone more to say about training in conventional bodhicitta and remember this, train in every activity by words? Because this is the relative, you know, how we are in the world, you know. Happy to move on? Okay, so now we get to training in ultimate bodhicitta. So it says, show the secret to the one who has achieved stability. Well, that can mean a few things. And technically speaking, it's people who've you know, got a stable meditation, stable shine. But I think it can also mean people who have stable refuge and stable faith in the Dharma. And the secret is emptiness. You know, that's the secret teaching, that things are not inherently existent. And so the first is the emptiness of the outside world, you know. Think all phenomena are like dreams. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, you know. And I know that if you'd like to tomorrow, you know, I mean, one of the mind trainings, when it says train in all activities by words, the one that Lama Zopa really recommends is, this is a dream, this is a dream, this is a dream, this is a dream. I mean, he's been saying that forever. I mean, he's been saying the same thing for 40 years because we don't get it. So he has to keep saying the same thing. Oh, I remember my mother, she used to go to Rinpoche, she says, he always says the same thing. Because she's used to the Christian church where they're like, you know, taking a lesson and talking about this and that. He always says the same thing. And I said, yeah, because we have to hear it over and over and over again, you know. He's still saying the same thing. Talk about patience. It's a little lighter than it used to be. But I remember years ago, 1980 or 81, I was like, think of all things like a dream. And the instruction was all day long, like a dream, like a dream, like a dream. Even when you look at yourself, like a dream, you know, it's like a dream. Because yeah, because things don't, I mean, it's easy to understand that things don't exist from their own side in the dream. They're just coming from your mind, you know. But this isn't that much different. It just appears to be not different, you know. Because when you're in a dream, it seems really real, isn't it? You know. And in actual fact, this isn't really real either. It just appears to be that way. Because this is an ongoing dream. You know, we wake up in this. One way to think about it is we wake up in the same dream every day. What was that movie about the guy that kept waking up?
Groundhog Day.
Yeah, Groundhog Day.
Yeah. Brilliant film.
It's like we live in Groundhog Day, you know, every day. We don't have to repeat the same thing, but we wake up every day in the same body with these same things and the same stuff. But really, it's no different than being in a dream, because one day we're going to wake up in a different body. It's going to be a different dream. And we won't even remember this dream. So that's one thing to help us not be quite so serious about this life. Because, you know, for one thing, it's going to end quickly. And then you just, if they say that at the time of death, you know, your whole life flashes before you like a dream. So that's a really important mind training, that it's like a dream. Particularly when we were talking about all these other difficult situations, you know, if we can remember, it's like a dream. You know, and another thing, you know, if you say to yourself, this is a dream, another good thing about that is if you get in the habit of doing that, when you're actually in a dream, if you say this is a dream, you can wake up in a dream. Have any of you ever woken up in a dream and you're in a dream?
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? And it feels just like this.
That's one of the things that Rabina always says before you go to sleep.
Yeah.
When you're having a dream, try and realize that it actually is a dream.
Yeah.
And see if you can change it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
Yeah, I managed it once.
Yeah. Because, and one of the ways to do that is to remind yourself throughout the day that this is a dream. So you get in the habit of going, this is a dream, you know. Some people who are avidly, actively doing lucid dreaming, they say, just look at your hand all day long. This is a dream, you know, look at your... So then when you're in a dream, you remember to look at your hand. This is a dream, and you wake up in your dream. And the reason, another reason besides just understanding emptiness is important is because, you know, after we die, we go into the bardo. Everybody here knows about the bardo, the intermediate state. Well, between bodies, between like a physical body, it's like a non-physical body. It's like a dream body. And that happens when you die. And it's very much like a dream body because it feels like your body, but there's no actual flesh and blood. You still, and bardo beings often go back to their families and hang around, but they don't, you see them and they don't see you, you know? And that's one of the reasons why Tibetans, not always, but it can usually, they say it's a set of seven, every 7 days the bardo being dies again and gets another body. Until one of them is actually a physical body. And it might be a human, or it might be a pig, or it might be a, you know, hell being or a predator being. You don't know what it's going to be. But if you can learn to wake up in a dream, then you can learn to wake up in the bardo and actually direct your next rebirth, which is what tulkus are, what a reincarnated lama is. It's somebody that has awareness in the bardo. And actually, because a bardo being... The body goes wherever the body thinks. You know, there's no, it's like, you know, because you don't have a physical, you know, if you just think somewhere, you're there. So if you have this capacity really well, then if you know some, you know, young couple and you want them to be your parents, you think about them at the time of death. When you're in the bardo, you think about them, you go right there. And the next time they're making love, boom, they're your parents. And that's what Buddhists do. That's how they come back. That's how we have Kirti Sintra Rinpoche and Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Rinpoche and the Dalai Lama. They've done that. They're so skilled in their meditations that they've learned how to wake up in a dream. So it's not just to have fun. It's really a really good thing to know how to do. And, you know, as we get older, it's something to really, I think, focus on, you know, in your practice. And a retreat is a much better time to do that because you have less things going on in your mind, because so much of what we dream now, we're just processing the events of the day. But what happens when you do retreat is nothing happens in the day. So, except, you know, you practice and you eat and you go for a walk, and especially if you're in silence. And so your dream time then becomes very, very alive. And that's one of the most fun things about it. And, I mean, for me in long retreats, I always look forward to the dream time more than the daytime. I like the dream time better. You know, it's not as hard. So think all phenomena are like dreams. It's not only just to realize for emptiness, you know. But the point is that, you know, everything we experience, you know, in the previous one, it was like, everything we experience is the result of my karma, but now it's like everything we experience outside of ourselves is empty. It doesn't exist from its own side. And, you know, the two main things that Lama Zopa talks about are actually these two main points of relative and ultimate bodhicitta. He says the two things, at least when we were in Pamaya, was it last year? 2017, he said that over and over and over again in many different ways. But the thing was, is in the break time, remember that it's all a creation of your mind, you know? And the other thing is that it's all empty. And just then I think I said this yesterday, you know, an appearance comes, there's an appearance. And although it's empty, we don't see it as empty. And immediately our mind labels it flower. You know, first just comes shape, color. You know, there's just white and a shape. That's all the mind sees. You know, that's all the eye sees. But then the mind then goes, oh, that's a flower. Because I got that name when I was a kid. Somebody told me, oh, that's a flower. You know, and what do flowers do? And I have all these concepts about flowers. But in the beginning, it's just a shape and a color. And so then comes the label. And then after that, I believe that label. And so what Lama Zopa says constantly is that suspend that belief in the labels, you know, and just realize that what we're experiencing is like a dream, shapes and colors, emotions and feelings. But it's these paths, this is why karma is so important. It's these past karmic imprints that put those labels. And, you know, they say that what we see is a glass of water, a pratta being sees as blood, and a being in the God realm sees it as nectar. It's the same basis, you know, but it's because of our karmic propensities we label it different things. And so that's what we need to understand about emptiness is, you know, there is a basis, and the basis for this particular purpose does exist, you know. But it only exists in dependence upon my mind labeling it as thus. And the thing that's about it is that, okay, the basis you can also realize is merely labeled. And so you can kind of go down ad infinitum. It's like you can break the, you know, even though for the purpose of labeling it, you know, there is some existence of it. But it never truly exists because if you look at its parts, they're made of parts. And you look at their parts, and they're made of parts. And so you go down, everything's labeled, labeled, labeled. Even when you get down to the atoms, you know, there's a north and south, east, west side of an atom. So you can just keep going down until you just get there's nothing left, you know. There's only emptiness, you know. However, everything exists, everything functions, you know. And we can know that, you know, we can identify the basis by its function. Like you can't, I mean, salt and sugar look the same, you know. So, but you can't label salt sugar or sugar salt because that's not how they function, you know. So you can't just go around going, everything's from my mind, therefore I can, you know, change everything, you know. It's not like that, you know. There is actual reality out there, you know. But what we can change is our response to it and the way we label it and the way we see it, because that's all coming from our side. You know, so what we want to understand is how this constant labeling is going on, you know. And it's that's causing us to perceive things as truly existent, that then we get friend, enemy, stranger, you know, or good, bad, and ugly, or, you know, taste good, taste bad, or, you know, whatever, all the things that we do that cause us to create karma. So we need to study about the emptiness of the phenomena, but then we also, the next one is analyze the unborn nature of awareness or of cognition. So that means even my mind that labels, you know, we've been doing that, you know, that you can't find that either. You know, if you look where, you know, there's just moments of mind, you know, and they arise together, you know. There's a basis, the mind labels it, the everything, it arises. That's what they call dependent arising, you know. They arise together, and on the basis of that dependent arising of a subject and an object, there's our reality, you know. And if you break it down, the object doesn't truly exist, I don't truly exist. You know, that's where the freedom lies, you know. And just even knowing that helps, you know, even if you don't realize that, you know. And so, you know, that's why, you know, I've been sitting here, you know, asking us to just, I find it extremely helpful just to allow myself to suspend any kind of thinking or thought and just rest in my mind, you know. And just know that, and over time, you know, if you keep looking all the time, you know, for not just the eye, you know, doesn't exist, but the mind also, the mind also is empty, you know. And so when you realize that the mind is empty, then you realize you can see that everything appearing to the mind is also empty. Right? Is that, am I making any sense?
Yeah.
So it's quite liberating, actually, especially when you can just kind of rest in that state of feeling that pure awareness, you know? The unborn nature of awareness. They call it unborn because when you look for the mind, you know, it has, there's no coming, there's no going, there's no staying. You can't pinpoint any moment of mind, you know. It that's in our Prajnaparamita, you know, beyond speech, unborn, unceasing, you know. It's just constantly kind of like a wave in the ocean, you know. And I mean, I think if you're in a boat in the middle of the sea, it's kind of like that, you know, unborn, unceasing. There's just this endless amount of water, and the waves are coming and going. And so the waves are, you know, I like that one because the waves aren't separate from the sea, but yet they appear separate, don't they? And that's exactly how the mind is, you know. Thoughts appear to be separate from the bigger, you know, mind, the sea of mind. But it's only because we're focusing on them that they appear that way. But in actual fact, they are the same stuff as the mind without thought. It's the same. They call it the clarity of mind. You know, the clarity of mind is always there. And so even when you're not thinking, there is this clarity of mind. And it's like the potential for a thought. You know, and that will be there whether you're thinking or not. And so that's like the ocean, and it's potential to have a wave, you know. And so when you can relax enough to not have any thoughts, then you can just see that there's no arising, there's no coming, there's no going, because when you penetrate the emptiness of that thought, it doesn't have a beginning or an end, you know. I mean, you can watch it if you're watching it, you know. But the mind itself, when you find the emptiness of those experiences, and a really good meditator never experiences arising or ceasing of a thought. You know, it's just emptiness appearing as a thought. You know, it's not something that comes and goes. It's just clarity. You know, the great meditators, it's like there's clarity with thought, there's clarity without thought. You know, and every time a thought comes, it's just like the wave on the water. It's just another form of this clarity, but they never leave that state. You know. And that's kind of our goal, is that, you know, there's the clarity and then there's the awareness of that. But even the awareness itself isn't anything. You know, it's not an I, it's not a me, it's not my awareness. And I think that's the hard thing about us. It just, mind just is, you know. Mind is just, it just exists, you know, and it exists in an empty state. And as soon as we have a subject and object, then it appears to exist from its own side. But that's just constantly coming and going, you know. Dependent arising is coming, dependent arising is going. And it's just our tendency to want to hold on to things and make them concrete, which is just, and unfortunately, it's just an innate thing that comes with being a being, you know, as we have this innate need to solidify everything. And yes, this is, you know, that's that, and this is that, and this is that. Instead of just allowing things to just be in their true nature, you know. And it's just how it is, you know. A cat meows and a dog barks, and we have minds that go, you know. And so it's nothing to, like, something bad about it. It's just that nature that we need to try to turn around, you know. And it takes a very, very subtle awareness to be able to meditate on emptiness. And right now, ours are pretty gross, you know. But it's not impossible. And also, a thing that's really important, and I haven't really even talked about the guru yet, maybe we will at the end. And I noticed in one of the books I was reading, the preliminaries, you know, they had the whole Lam Rim. But the Lama here is very important, particularly if you have a highly realized Lama. And that when you request blessings, it's part of the needs thing, you know, requesting. I was just asking about, you know, other things. But the one we really want to request is the blessing to understand emptiness. To not only understand it, but then experience it. And that's what, you know, in the Kagyu and the Nyingma, they talk about the pointing out instruction. You know, when you sit with the guru and the guru meditates on emptiness. And if you relax and open enough, you'll get a taste of it. And in our tradition, it's when we take the empowerments. You know, we get the empowerment. There's a part of the empowerment, particularly the word empowerment, where the guru will give you the blessing. And sometimes, you know, bam, you get a taste. Wow. You know, you get a little taste of it. And once you get that taste, this is the reason why we have commitments. The theory behind a commitment is that the guru is giving you the taste of that emptiness. And by you're committed to going back to it every day so that you don't forget it. It's not because you've punished or it's a bad thing. It's just because you got that blessing and you want to remember it every day. You know, so you go back to that. And as best as you can, you know, you try to remember that experience that was. And you don't actually really have to be with the Lama to get that blessing. You just have to have faith and really, you know, and pray like Carolyn Miss, you got to shout, I want it, you know. I thought that was really cool. So, you know, really, and really mean it from your heart, you know, with the bodhicitta motivation. And you will get that blessing. And then, you know, that thing about grasping, you just begin to realize what a joke it is, you know. I mean, it still comes, but you can just sort of laugh at it. Or it's like now I go, oh, there's that eye again. What to do about it, you know. But you get to the point where you don't buy into it anymore. I mean, there are times, like your challenge every day, you know. I mean, if I would be that way too, you know. But, you know, there are times when it's there. But even then, you know, you can, you know, 2 seconds later go, aha, you got caught again, you know. So, and the other thing that's good about emptiness is it's really blissful. It's very happy. And so you want to go back there, you know, because it's a state of really of peace and joy and, you know, all that kind of... Because, you know, for me, having a self, having an ego, it's a burden. It's a burden we carry around. And I remember I read a book, I think I was telling Kat about Mark Epstein. He's another Buddhist psychologist who writes. I haven't read his more recent books because I don't have time to read anymore. I don't take time to read anymore. And I think it might have been his very first book, Thoughts Without a Thinker. He says, the reason we love being in love so much is because being in love, we lose the burden of ego. And I never thought about that before. And I thought, it's kind of true, you know. It's like you sort of get caught up in this, you know, oneness with some other being or whatever. I don't know what you say, but it's kind of like this stick that you have to carry around, you know, in your heart, you know. Oh God, you know, this thing, you know, this mind that's always complaining and wanting and needing, and then it's happy and then it's sad and then it's doing this and then it's doing that, and it's exhausting, isn't it? And so I think that's one of the reasons we like to sleep. We're finally like, oh God, I don't have to be me anymore, you know? But emptiness is the other way out, you know? It's just, there's no more me left. And it just feels really good to be relieved of that burden of a self. And so it's really helpful to look for the I. Where is the I? Can't find the I. And then just resting in that state, you know. And really, it takes a long time to... one of the texts I've studied, you know, says that when in learning to meditate on emptiness, the most important thing is to really be able to identify what we call the object to be refuted. you know, the object, the I, you know, the one that comes up when we're afraid or angry or full of desire or jealousy or some strong emotion. In Rinpoche, he calls it the emotional I, you know. Because it's not that we don't have a self. We don't have this merely labeled I. But he says, you know, that one's so subtle, it's like it doesn't exist, you know. So we don't want to become nihilists here, you know. We do exist, you know, but it's not the one that we feel now. That one that we feel now doesn't exist. What I'm seeing now doesn't exist. You know, what we call, you know, the relative truth, that doesn't exist at all. The only real relative truth that exists is the one that exists for the being who's realized emptiness and can see the appearance of something. But for what exists for us now, it doesn't exist at all. Jeffrey Hoffman calls it truth for a jerk. I like that. You know? And it doesn't mean that karma doesn't operate and that we don't have to take care of our karma, because we still see it, you know, full on, concrete, you know. And so our best escape is to create the cause by, you know, creating virtue. That's why we have all these teachings and all this stuff, because we don't have enough potential to meditate on emptiness now. So we have to do all these other things to create that potential, so that when we do request the guru, we do have the blessing, you know. And just that little gap can come. And I know some people here, you know, probably dabbled in psychedelics in their lifetime, and I think that was one of the things that, you know, LSD and mushrooms, it does give you that break. It does. I think some people, especially if they had past imprints, you know, had to take. I'm not advising to take drugs, but, you know, did have a taste of emptiness, you know, in the psychedelic experience, which is what made people go to Nepal to study with the lamas. I mean, I've heard Lama Zopa Rinpoche say the kindness of the drugs, you know. If it weren't for the drugs, the hippies wouldn't have started this, all this stuff, you know. You know, I mean, Ram Dass and Timothy Leary with their LSD experiments and, you know, going off to India, and it started this whole thing in the 60s, you know. So, yeah. Anyway, what else to say? Other than...
Could you always get the confused between consciousness and mind? So what is the mind stream that goes forward with the Bardo? Is that mind or is that consciousness?
It's a very, very subtle mind, or it doesn't matter if you call it consciousness or mind. But they usually use the word mind. It's a very, very, very subtle mind that also, I mean, I don't really understand it. That I mean, it also doesn't exist from its own side, but yet it holds karmic imprints. Yeah. Now you explain that to me. I mean, I've asked lamas to explain it to me, and I think they have, but I'm too dumb to.
Because I start to get a little hint.
Yeah.
And then
Well, we just need more merit, you know. But there is a very, I mean, and that's what when I tell you, you know, to visualize the Mother Prajnaparamita dissolving into that subtle drop. That's the very subtle drop of her very subtle mind to come and mix with our very subtle drop in our very subtle mind. And that's why it's important to do that, because even though we don't really know what it is, you know, we're creating the neural pathways, you know, to at least have the structure of it coming, you know. And the more we do it, the more... you know, we get closer to that, particularly because I don't really know how it works, but there is something about blessing, receiving blessings from Buddhas, you know. And so the more we do that, the closer we get to actually, the important thing is to think, you know, my mind is inseparable from the guru's mind. And there will be a blessing when you do that. Particularly if you can, you know, learn to let your mind sink down, however you want to do it, with your taps or your breathing or whatever. You know, and you get to that point because we have a mind, you know, we have a subtle mind. That's the one that we work with when we're doing qigong and taps and all that stuff. That's the one that rides on the winds. But then we have this very subtle mind that we cannot experience unless we're a great yogi that can enter and abide the winds in the central channel, which is what the six yogis of Naropa are about. And that's the goal for us actually in this life, is to be able to experience that very settled mind before we're dead. The only other time is when we're dead. And so what happens when we die is all those winds enter in the central channel, and then it leaves the body when the body stops, you know. And so if we're lucky, it leaves through the crown of the head. If we're not so lucky, if we're going to the lower realms, it leaves through the lower part of the body. And if you've ever been with a dying person, there will be a little drop of blood either out the nose or out the tip of the sex organ when they finally have left. Because when beings stop breathing, they're not dead yet. It just means that the gross mind is gone, but the subtle mind is still absorbing into the heart chakra. And so what yogis do is they consciously absorb the winds into the heart chakra so that then they can practice bardo yoga. You know, they can go leave their bodies and, you know, go to some other place. They can go visit you in your dream time, which is why lamas can actually come and visit, you know. If we sometimes, you know, a dream with the lamas, actual lamas there in our dream time, you know, because they can do that. They can just leave. You know, Lama Yeshe used to do that. And I'm sure Rinpoche can do that. And so that very subtle mind is what goes from life to life to life. And of course, you know, it has a relative existence, but it's also empty. So maybe the karma's, you know, sticking on the relative part. But I think it's a lot more complicated than we can imagine. You know, it's not just, you know, one dimensional. I'm going, you know, my friend Lama, who's in retreat, she seems to think it's sort of like these random things, you know, flipping through space, you know, these random karmas and random this. And we just happen to be one of these random things that colliding with other random things. And it kind of makes more sense to me that way, you know.
Yes, because I asked that question from a teacher and they said, absolutely not.
Absolutely what not?
No, it's not random. Oh, it is okay. Your karma.
Yeah.
From past lives.
But it's almost like there's random things, but your karma picks up on them. That's kind of more what I mean.
Okay, so
yeah, I'm not saying it's not all random, but there's sort of like these random things floating around, you know? But it's your karma that brings them to you, right? Yeah. But there are these different propent karmic things, you know? Like all of us, right? We have, you know, we've been these little karmas floating around, but somehow we're all drawn together this time in this life, you know, that we meet each other this life, you know. And I know you've all had the experience when you meet someone, you felt like you met them before, you know. It's a close karmic connection from a past life. Or even the things you like to do, you probably did them in a past life, you know. Nothing really new happening here. We just keep doing the same old things. So, and I like to think of it in chemistry, you know, when I don't know very much about chemistry, but I did have to take a year of it in university, and that was a long time ago. But one of the things I thought was so cool about it is the idea that, you know, in an atom, you know, there's the nucleus, you know, the proton. And then there are these electrons, the negative things that float around it, you know, and there are these things called valence levels. And so they move out, and you know, and the bigger the atom, you know, like you looking at the periodic table, it's because how many electrons they have moving out, you know. And it takes that electron to have a lot of energy to move to the next department, you know, the next level. And I feel like that's like us, you know. It's like we have to build up all this karmic potential so that we can jump to the next level of development as a Buddha, you know. So we're like spinning, you know. That's what all this stuff is, you know, all these mantras and prostrations and service, and so that we can, because it takes a lot of energy, potential energy within our mind stream to jump up to another level of understanding emptiness, or another level of being able to deal with anger, or another level of being able to have more compassion. You know, all that stuff takes potential. And that's what merit is to me. You know, the merit is the potential to practice virtue. And we have to create that. It's like we're building that up. We're building it up so we can move to the next level and not be. And so, you know, the whole point about our perfect human rebirth is we want to get that. We want to cram as much of that in there this time around, you know, because who knows what was going to be next time, you know? Because we die with ignorance, we have no control over where we're going to be born. You know, I remember the first time people heard that, this disbelief. You know, I mean, I could go to a lower realm. You certainly can. You know, and so that's another reason why, you know, you go to sleep at night, to go to sleep. And we'll get to that. That's what comes tomorrow. We're going to talk about all these things, the five powers. You know, going to sleep. Before you go to sleep at night, you actually, I mean, sometimes, or a lot of the time, you know, we're too tired, we just like crash. But if you're really a good practitioner, blame, shame, you know. then before you go to sleep at night, in fact, it's good to, you know, like write it by your bed, you know, put it up there, you know. You go to sleep at night, you think about bodhicitta, you know. I'm going to become enlightened for all sentient beings, you know. And you give everything away, you know. You give all your stuff away because you don't want to be grasping at things at the time of death, you know. And you can go to sleep doing Tonglin every night. And that's, you know, if we're not these great yogis who can, you know, do into the winds in the central channel, the best insurance is Tonglin. That's another reason it's a good thing to practice every day, because if you're so habituated to it at the time of death that you do Tonglin, maybe not with yourself, but with others. By then, hopefully, we won't need it for ourselves anymore. But I know we'll always need it. But anyway, if we practice doing Tonglin at the time of death, we're kind of guaranteed we'll have another perfect human rebirth, because we're going to sleep, you know, or dying, you know, taking on others' suffering and giving everybody everything they want. You know, we're dying with bodhicitta motivation. So that's another reason to be practicing bodhicitta all day long. Because at the death time, we're not going to have, you know, it's not, we go unconscious when we die. And so it's again about creating those neural pathways. You want to have the habit. I want to get enlightened. I want to get enlightened. I care about others. I care about others. I want to get enlightened. I want to get, I care about others. I care about others. Because that is the ticket. Because it's all about the mind. It's all about what we store on our mind, you know, and what kind of imprints we make, which is why the other day I was talking about being lazy. You know, my laziness is not being aware of that. But it takes merit to get there, you know, which is why we can start with just trying to be kind, you know, maybe offer some service or, you know. And it's important to, I don't know, I'm talking so much, but it's important to, like, recognize, you know, where we are and figure out what we can do with a happy mind that creates the cause for enlightenment, you know. Like, I happen to be, I have the karma to do retreat this life, so I did that. But if you have the karma to be something else, do that. It doesn't matter so much. I mean, after all these years, I realize, you know, it's not so much what we do. It's our motivation. And it's more, and it's better to be happy, you know, than to try to squeeze yourself. You know, that thing about, I mean, with me, with ordination, it was always just this square peg in a round hole, you know. It just, you know, I mean, I tried, you know, and I just realized at some point in time, you just have to have a lifestyle that works for you, that supports you. So find that, find out what that is, know what you like to do, do it. But then, and do it. And the reason that's important is so that your mind is free enough to go, I'm going to get enlightened, I'm going to get enlightened, I'm doing this with sentient beings, you know. But if you're constantly stressed, it's really hard to remember that. And I know, you know, sometimes we don't have the circumstances where we can be unstressed. And then we just have to practice patience. But, you know, most of all, if you can just wake up in the morning, I'm so glad I'm here. You know, I'm motivating this day to become enlightened for all sentient beings, to help people. You just, like, who was it? The one who likes the Dalai Lama's one, wasn't it you?
Yes.
You know, yeah, I'm here today to remember to be kind to all sentient beings. I'm going to make the most use of my perfect human rebirth. I'm going to help others as much as I can, you know. If you think that, and then you just try your best every day, and then you go to sleep doing Tonglin and make a note of, well, I wasn't so good at that. Maybe I'll try to do that better next time. That regret thing you were talking about, you know. That's part of also going to sleep, is just recognizing the mistakes you made that day. Not because I'm bad, you know, not just because it's like anything. You know, if you were learning to, you know, cook food. Well, I put too much salt in there today. I think tomorrow I'll have less salt. It's as simple as that, you know. It's like this thing of, don't make it so personal, you know. It's not about me, you know. It's like you are your project, you know. You're your art project that you're trying to, you know. And it's your project. This life is your project. Is I'm growing a Buddha. This life, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that amazing? You know, I get to become a Buddha because I've met with these Dharma teachings, and you know, and the more I understand about what samsara is, you know, the more we want to get out, right? Especially because we know that even the baby steps we take help all sentient beings, you know? So it's just so marvelous, you know? This whole thing is just so marvelous. So anyway, I better stop talking. So anyway, that's ultimate bodhicitta. That's the best I can do, I think, tonight with that. And so, oh, let's finish it, because tomorrow, we just have tomorrow. So, analyze the unborn nature of awareness. So that's the fact that, mind is empty. And then even the antidote is free from existing from its own side. What that means is emptiness is empty too.
Yes.
So don't think that emptiness is like something you can hold on to, or it's like God, you know. It's not. There's nothing. I mean, it's really beyond our concept, you know, that there's something that is beyond concept, because we are such conceptual beings, you know.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
It's self-cherishing mind is the biggest threat to a self-cherishing mind. So
yeah.
Saying, that doesn't feel right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's why they, you know, recognize. I mean, I think that's why, you know, if you read these traditional texts, they're pretty heavy, you know. Your self-charge, your mind is your enemy, you need to beat it up, you need to do this, you need to do that, you know. And I mean, that might work for, you know, 11th century monks, but I don't really think it works for us. But they're still great texts. You just have to kind of temper them a bit, you know. And also it's nice to read more contemporary ones, like Trungpa and like that. I'd be great if Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche wrote one. I'm sure it'd be just fantastic. Because he is so contemporary. In fact, he said, I heard him say, he was giving a commentary on the words of my perfect teacher, actually. It's really great commentary. Maybe you can get it online. It was just that you have to listen to it.
Can you say that name again?
Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche. He's not so young anymore. But he's just a wonderful contemporary lama, you know, who's... He's actually was Rime. He's trained in Gelugpa, Nyingma, Sakya, and Kagyu, and Sakya. But he's the grandson of Dingo Khyentse Rinpoche, and the son of Trinley Norbu. So he comes from a long line of great lamas, and he's basically Nyingma Lama. But he's very funny. His books are great, and he doesn't have that many books, but I'm sure he has YouTubes and stuff. But anyway, I'm just trying to say, he said, forget about enlightenment this lifetime. You know, you're so hung up on enlightenment. He said, just think about not letting yourself be defeated by your circumstances. And I think that's so great, you know, because he said, that is going to bring us to enlightenment. You know, we don't have to think about down there. Just basically saying, not being defeated by the circumstances is practicing thought training. You know, being able to transform. You know, and sometimes, you know, we're in a difficult situation. We have to really think about, how am I going to transform this? You know, so it's not going to get me down. I'm not going to just fall into despair or negativity or anger. You know, sometimes you have to be creative about how you're going to figure out how I'm going to transform the situation. And the other thing I think is important, and Carl touched on it, is get out of it if you can. You know, I mean. A lot of us, I mean, I used to use this the analogy of, because, I mean, you know, when I would do these long retreats, I was committed. I couldn't get out of it, you know. So I had to, you know, be kind of like forced to transform the situation. It's the same with being a mother or a job, or, you know, maybe you can change your jobs. But relationships are changeable too, unless you really see that, you know, you have to decide if a relationship is really destructive. Or if if the you know, the strife that you feel is helping your Dharma practice. But if it's just sending you down, down, down into depression, maybe you better let it go, you know. And so I used to think, well, you know, those lamas, all the ones that could escape Tibet, they did. They didn't stay there in the prisons to be tortured so they could practice mind training. You know? The ones that were stuck, that didn't have the karma to get out, they did, and they were magnificent in their mind training. But the ones that could leave, leave. So if you're in a situation, if you can, you know, don't stay there because, oh, I have to be a good Buddhist. You know, if it's time to leave Land of Joy, it's time to leave Land of Joy, isn't it? You know? If you're working and you've worked to the point where, you know, you need a break, you know. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that too.
He asked me to go skiing with him once. You know, when you go the rounds in Bodh Gaya to all the Rinpoches, and he said, honey, do you ski? No. Would you like to come with me? I'm going to, what's that place in America that's very famous?
Vail or Aspen.
Aspen. He yes. said, supposedly he does go skiing.
Yeah. Well, did you go with him?
No. That'd be a danger.
Yeah. Anyway, he's great.
Skiing lama.
Yeah.
Wonderful image.
Yeah, well, he's pretty contemporary, you know. He's the one who made the movies, The Cup, and he's made 3 movies, I think.
There's
Magic
lots of good
something.
Pictures of him on his Facebook and about him with Keanu Reeves for the Little Buddha.
He's very contemporary.
He's very young, but he's not so young now, as you said.
Yeah, he's probably in his 50s now, I guess. I don't know. But he's been through a lot, you know. I think he disrobed and had a relationship and that didn't last, and he's been through a lot of things, but he's a very good teacher. So let's just stop now, and it's getting late. I know we also need our rest here. So tomorrow morning we'll do 3 and 4. I guess we'll see how far we get with that. Because these are very good teachings as well. And it's basically the same thing. Yeah. Apply meditation to whatever circumstances you meet, you know. So anyway, so let's just sit and we'll just sit for a few minutes, because Keith is right, sitting too long is not helpful. And there was a teaching from Kali Rinpoche, who's another lama that passed away a long time ago. He was also quite popular in the 70s and 80s, and now he's probably about 35 too. And he said one time, he said, because I don't recognize the clarity of my mind, I think there's an object out there. I don't think he said out there. There's an object. And because I don't recognize the emptiness of mind, I think there's a subject. So, in other words, there's just clarity and emptiness. And awareness of that. So making a request to the Guru is just imagine that, you know, the object dissolves into space, into emptiness. We can use space as an example, you know. And myself, my eye dissolves into space. And then those two spaces, space and there's no difference between space and space.
Space is
empty. Yeah. So, you know, if we let the experience of the other dissolve into space and the self dissolve into space, all we're left is with space. And within that space, there's clarity and awareness. So just work with that for a little while. And when a thought comes, just see it as the wave on the water, or the reflection in the mirror. And Ramyeshi used to say, penetrate. You just penetrate that mind, that thought with awareness, it'll just resolve back into the sea of spacious clarity and emptiness. In emptiness, there's no arising of thought, no cessation of thought. Because the thoughts themselves don't have true existence. Now we can, in the evening, with requesting the Buddhas to bless us, to be able to quickly realize the ultimate bodhicitta and the relative bodhicitta, and to create the merit of the positive potential to attain enlightenment as fast as we can. Because all the sentient beings are waiting. They're hurting. The suffering of change, and the all-pervasive suffering, just having this burden of ego, you know, this burden of contaminated aggregates, suffering. It's with us all the time. All-pervasive suffering. The only time it's not there is when we meditate on emptiness, or when we're experiencing emptiness. So imagine we'll just do 7 Buddha Shakyamuni mantras, and just imagine all the blessings the Buddhas are pouring into us, giving us the perfect guidance that we need for our particular karmic situation, this life. We can make the most of this perfect human rebirth in a nurturing, supportive, and happy way. We can persevere in these hardships, with these difficult situations, and find ways to transform them and live with them and be patient with them, because it will change eventually, and be able to use them all as fuel for our motivation to attain enlightenment for all sentient beings. Chayata Muni Muni Maha Munaye Soha Taya Ta Muni Muni Maha Munaye Soha Taya Ta Chaya cha om ni muni maha munaye soha. Chaya cha om ni muni maha munaye soha. Chaya cha just feel that gentle rain of blessings is bringing us all the strength we need, and the awareness, and the patience, and the kindness, and the inspiration and faith to swim upstream towards enlightenment. By this merit may I become Buddha and lead all beings into that enlightened state. May supreme Bodhi. not to rise and rise and grow. And what has arisen not decline, but increase forevermore. We also dedicate for the long lives of our teachers, Swami Sri Dalai Lama, Sopa Rinpoche, Dog Rinpoche, all our teachers, and not just our teachers, but all the great lamas out there. May they all live long, and the reincarnations become great teachers again. And for all those people, like you people here, who are helping people with therapy and charities, and just in our daily lives, helping people. May we have all the conditions we need to do that, and may the Dharma centers have all the volunteers and money and resources and teachers, and continue to flourish and grow, and may all the NGOs flourish and grow, and may the information world become more truthful, and people wake up, and we elect wise leaders and find solutions to these very pressing problems. And for all beings to be free of suffering and of happiness and all the conditions they need for temporal and ultimate happiness. So, thanks so much. We made it through another day. Let's hope we all wake up in the morning. I think we will. So we'll see you in the morning at 7:30, okay? And by the way, this is a good book. I think I recommended it. Geshe Rabdin, Advice from a Spiritual Friend. His the teaching on emptiness on the ultimate bodhicitta in here. I should have read it before tonight, but I didn't. Anyway, it's really good. I studied it many times. I think this is one of the best for me as a beginner. You know, I mean, I'm still a beginner, but it was one of the best teachings on emptiness. And Geshe Rabdin also has another book that I think is out of print, and we should get Wisdom to reprint it, because I think it's called Meditations on Emptiness. There's a little white book that came out in the 80s, and I bet, you know, you might find it on Amazon or Thrift Books or something. But it's a whole book on emptiness from Geshe Rabdin. It's just so excellent. And I think I have a few notes from it upstairs. I'll bring them down tomorrow and read them to you. Because I was in Laodo in 2017, and I found it in the library there and reread it again. So great to read it again, you know. It's even a little skinny book, you know. But I think it's called Meditations on Emptiness. Geshe Rabdin, R-A-B-T-E-N. He was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. Okay, here's your book back. Thanks for lending.